While we were interviewing on the maybe the third day, he said, let's go down to the IUD convention. That's the Industrial Union Department of the AFL-CIO. It's on. And having someone with him allowed him to be able to walk in and act like he was doing something, it turned out. We went down to the IUD convention, and I knew a lot of the people there, particularly UAW people. And they were stiffing him. He would go up to them obliquely so that he wouldn't get totally embarrassed if they wouldn't speak to him. And he'd go by them just right, studied way, so that if they did nod to him that they would speak, he could stop, or if they did not, he'd go on and not look like he had planned to talk to them at all. And he would introduce me and the National Science Foundation interviewing him right now and so on. Something big in his life, this little thing. And he was utilizing it. And I would say that of the people that we went to, at least half stiffed him flat out, and the others would only say, oh yeah, Jim, how are you, and turn and wave him off and stiff him, you know, trying to be nice and yet doing it anyway. And then a few would talk to him. Particularly the more the UAW guys would talk to him than steel workers and from the other unions and chemicals and all of that. And he could tell that he missed them. That traveling socially in that crowd of picards at the top, staffers and elected people, where he'd been such a big shot for so many years. James B. Carey organized Philco in Philadelphia in 1932. He was a major industrial union organizer, and the kinds of industrial organization that were built into that rank and file movement in Philly were used as the radical side of industrial union organization when finally John L. came out of the AFL in 1937. And one of the first guys that John L. grabbed was Jim Carrey. And he was one of the most prestigious people in the whole bureaucracy. And he had helped give them a bad name. Like a rogue cop is a nightmare for the rest of the police force. He was a rogue labor leader, had been caught doing something of which he was totally guilty and making the whole labor bureaucracy look bad. Their legitimation went down 10 points the first day he was caught. And it was a very sad way to see. For all the crap that he'd pulled in his life, it's still a sad thing to see a man not with respect, without the dignity that comes along with the respect given at least by a limited segment of the career population of the person. And it was a career population. It isn't as if you had to show good skills to get respect in this. Your respect in those circles is your ability to keep the rank and file at bay, not become embattled by them.
Was there something endemic in what happened to James Carey? Is there something endemic of the entire American labor movement? I mean, you yourself were close enough to the 30s to see the changes that had occurred in unionism between the 30s and the 60s, late 60s when you were doing these interviews, and now the changes that have continued.
Well, one of the things that comes to mind right away, simply because my mind is here now, And it may not be the most important, but the people who became the leaders of the new unions of the 30s were, by and large, in my experience, the sons of immigrants. With that stamp of conservatism, that shroud of conservatism is placed upon any kid who's the second generation in the country, whose parents are first generation immigrants. As your immigrant parents want you to make good, and you make good in terms of that society's values, not in any real rebel values. For example, when Jim, this ethnic business, here's this Irishman, James B. Carey, he organized RCA and did something illegal in the process. And they had him dead to rights. And I've forgotten what the precise... I wrote this. It's one of the things quoted in the book by that I mentioned by Warner and Edelstein. And it's one of the interviews that they feature most, is the interview with Carey. But he was called in before the judge to answer for this infraction of law in the process of organization. And the lawyer, the corporate lawyer for RCA, asked him a question which allowed his attorneys, Carey's attorneys, to call for a mistrial. And it was granted. It was so blatant. And Carey was absolutely taken off guard by this, didn't understand why such a famous and intelligent, knowledgeable, wise attorney would make such a mistake. And he walked up to him in the corridor afterward, and the man said, "Was your father so-and-so Carey of the Sons of Irish Freedom?"
I was going to guess something like this.
And they were, the corporate attorney was a member of that, mm-hmm. the Sons of Irish Freedom. And he let the kid off.
Yeah.
And some things go deep, mm-hmm. you know, even deeper than your job. Well, this guy was such a firm position, he didn't have to worry. There may have been other reasons for people wanting Carey not to get hung on that as well. We don't know. But this is as Carey told the story to me. Carey died much younger than he should have, I feel. He was a man who looked well, and he was not a drinker, a smoker. He ate well, and he didn't eat immense amounts. He was a trim man to the very end. But I think he died of boredom and heartbreak. And it was sad, because for all the effort and energy that goes into being a successful bureaucrat, finally, it's not very rewarding. And that comes very clear with Carey, because he got caught. But these men in the bureaucracy live long enough to see their counterparts who are a little older leave office through death, and what kind of deaths those men have. And they don't live ecstatically happy lives. They live always a life that's 10 steps ahead of some sort of rebellion or criticism or scandal at all times. And they're always burying bodies secretly. I don't mean that literally. Only figuratively. They're always burying information that would incriminate them and make them look like what they are, that is, non-Democrats. Mm-hmm. Small d.
Were they always non-Democrats? In the 30s, you say, Carey, you know, was an organizer in the 30s, organized Philco. other Union leaders, Lundberg that you knew, did these guys start out as bureaucrats?
I don't think so. Uh-huh. It may have started out with some cynicism.
And what kind of change?
Well, let's take Lundberg. Lundberg began to be heard of in San Francisco in 1932. He was in Seattle. That is, this is the man who was going to become the secretary treasurer of the Sailors Union of the Pacific. This was the man who was going to unseat Andrew Peruzeff as the head of the Sailors Union. Peruzeff had an immaculate reputation. He had spent his lifetime making idealistic speeches on the behalf of merchant seamen and their living conditions in particular, which were terrible for animals and with no pay, workaways, seagoing bums, is what they were forced to be because they didn't have any money, they were impoverished. And he had spent most of his life in Washington, D.C. as a
lobbyist
for Seaman's cause. He had to do that because there was no rank and file on its feet and fighting to lead directly against the employers. Well, by 1932, the third year of the Depression, you could see it in 31 already, evidences of it. Even as a boy in L.A., an open shop town. But in 32, it was coming, and there was already organization. And in 32, you heard so much about Lundberg from Seattle that sentiments began to be heard by Lundberg himself. Why don't you get down to the headquarters port where you can lead directly toward doing something? You're on the spot in the headquarters port. It's very important, the way the Sailors Union is set up, that you be in the headquarters port. Now here comes the headquarters port, this guy who is about 30 years old, who's marvelous physical shape, a good sailor, skilled, and tough, and pretty bright, and independent attitudes. He had a kind of syndicalist, wobbly, radical, rebellious character.
He kind of looked like a pug.
Yeah, he had nose pushed in already, you know, and he was lean, and he rolled when he walked. He was central casting. And he came down. And he led job actions before 34 that were really great stuff. And during the 34 strike, in a lot of instances up and down the coast, Sailors Union was leading the General Maritime Strike, not the ILWU. Seamen are more radical generally than longshoremen. When a ship leaves the dock, it's a molecular state, and the skipper is the dictator, and there's very little or no middle class as a buffer between. The only buffer you've got is the officers eat in one mess and the crew eats in another, and in that separation the power is sustained. Along with seagoing law, which soon you sign articles on a ship, you're no longer a full citizen of the United States. And I mean, that's merely the case when you're on ship's articles. You have maritime law on there. And longshoremen are tied to a more conservative landlocked law situation than citizens of a more regular community than our seamen. And Lundberg really and truly was the kind of a guy who knew how to play it demagogically. His rhetoric was great stuff, and enough of a Norwegian accent to just enough. Even when he became bureaucratized, he still knew how to handle crowds and well. In the Oakland General Strike, Bridges wouldn't come near the General Strike meetings. Lundberg came across the Oakland side of the bay and was the only one who would lead, even in attitude. He was only putting up a note in the front to get the thing stopped. But he did a good job, at least, of telling the people sitting there in the mass meetings that they were right and the authority was wrong. But in those days, it's pretty clear that he was willing to lead the rank and file on its own terms, by job action. The 34 award had built into it here you had a general maritime strike on the West Coast. Roosevelt appointed a National Longshoremen's Board of a panel of arbitrators, three, who would sit, and the participants in the strike would come before the arbitrators and plead their case. And the arbitrators would write the contract language to which they would try to get both sides to agree, so the 34 award or contract was not negotiated in a direct manner by the two sides, management and labors, but by the third party, the arbitration party. Written into this award were some very conservative things. For example, this award gave the longshoremen direct 50% control of their own hiring and dispatching process. Recruitment, in effect, full control to the industry. In effect, de facto, not de jure. And then it gave a series of job rules, legitimation, on and on.
Speed of the sling load limit,
the whole business. But part and parcel of the whole thing were three words: work as directed. The meaning that if you have a beef, you don't strike, you don't take direct action, you call for the arbitrator who comes to you within a half an hour from some office in the port and arbitrates the case right then and there on board ship or on the dock. So the job action was effectively being outlawed by this wonderful award that gives you a union with a grievance procedure and partial control of hiring. And number two, and just as big, although it took longer to show its total value for the employers, it legitimated, put into effect, the fact that management could introduce labor-saving devices at will without having to negotiate them into place. You see, a fight against new technology was going on in 32, 3, and 4 against the four-wheeler and the plasterboard. Let me finish the sentence. By acceptance of the 34 award, they had to give up their fight for against the new technology and let it come in, and they lost jobs, and they couldn't take direct action any longer. They did take direct action, with Bridges immediately leading the fight to stop the direct action so he could hold them to force the 34 award and not jeopardize it. That's the way it posed itself for him, or at least the way he talked to everybody. Same was true of Lundberg. So as soon as... Now, it took two more years before the Sailors Union got control of its hiring, and in the contract, 100% control of hiring. along with the Marine firemen, all the water tenders and wipers, MFOW&W and MCS, Marine cooks and stewards, got 100% controlled hiring. And incidentally, when the offshore unions of the maritime got 100% control, went for it and struck for it, the 36th strike, the ILWU did not simultaneously go on strike to win 100% for itself, but simply sat and supported the other strikes and kept itself at 50% of control. But the minute that you got this type of contract, where it's no direct action, where in effect during term of agreement you must not show your economic strength, that made Lundberg and all the others automatically disciplinarians of their own membership.
Mm-hmm. And alliances with, to an extent, with business and government.
Because you're always having to deal with them on questions of, hey, these guys are going to take, or are taking direct action. Now, I can get them back to work, but you shouldn't fire any of them. Or there ought to be, what's the word? At the end of this wildcat,
I know what you're talking about. No reprisals.
No reprisals, right. There's another term which escapes me at the moment. That's one thing. Now, for example, Lundberg in 36 by 36 is, he's got a brain trust supplied him by James P. Cannon and the Socialist Workers' Party. And they're all bright young guys, and Cannon himself is out there a great deal of the time. And there's a lot of sophistication here. In the formation of the Maritime Federation Pacific, a lot of the initiative on this was that of the Sailors Union and the Trotskyists rather than Bridges and the Stalinists.
Was Lundberg following the advice of Cannon, say?
And particularly in the beginning, it seems to me that he must have been following it with some, to some degree, some direct degree.
Wouldn't they have opposed these compromises?
There's no evidence that the SWP and the Sailors, or in and around the Sailors Union, or the CP in and around the ILWU ever opposed openly any one of these conservative contractual and structural, which became structural, victories for management. They weren't thinking in those terms. They weren't thinking in those terms about. They saw more in the wins in the contract than they saw in the losses and direct action and on the job. We see it in the Steelworkers Union, for example, in a very documented way. And Clinton Golden, who was the head of all organizing in the Steelworkers Union in North, in our SWOC Steelworkers Organizing Committee. And Harold Rutenberg, who was the International's Education Director, they wrote a book together called The Dynamics of Industrial Democracy, in which they, in the book, candidly explain that in order to organize the union, you had to have these indigenous workers on the job who were pro-union, and they would do the organizing job. But as soon as the contract was signed, then you had to train these people who had created the union to horse trade, to make deals, and if they couldn't do it, couldn't bring themselves to do it, you had to get them a job as an organizer far away someplace, or a management job, and if they wouldn't do any of those, you had to get rid of them. And that meant, they tell stories where they tell you the guy is going to be fired, and that the local union officials were the last ones he could get to go union when he was organizing the place, and he comes to the International for their help against these conservative and reactionary local union officials. And the International tells him to take a hike. And Golden and Rutenberg say, that's the way it had to be. You had to teach him that winning a grievance was no longer fight until you win. So the rank and file attitude of these radical good organizers was fight until you win a grievance instead of making deals. And in that book was published by Grosset and Dunlap in 1942, I believe, you see the conservatism already cemented in place that came along with this business unionism that John L. Lewis was bringing into this very radical industrial union movement that began before Lewis ever thought of doing it. That is, it begins in 31, 32. Lewis forms a CIO inside the AFL in 35 and doesn't bring it out into the public as an independent organization until 37. So that the CIO is a bureaucratization of the industrial revolution, of the rank and files industrial union revolution. And we know from the Adolf Germer papers, who was the number one lieutenant of John L. Lewis, in charge of UAW in the main, although he went into other unions. We know now that he directly, Germer, was fighting for the breaking up of the semi-autonomous stewards councils that the rank and filers who had formed these independent unions, industrial unions, were creating.
Well before the CIO in the early 30s, unionism in the United States was only had one direction to go, and that was
vertical. Now, World War II hastened the ossification of that by light years. That is, let's take the UAW. For an example, all this new war industry is created. Now, UAW, along with John L. and all the others, has already made a deal. If you guys, says Roosevelt, the king inviting the dukes in, you guys keep production rolling for me, I won't oppose you. You'll get all these war industry workers into your dues base without a struggle. We will let you have it. And so in the UAW, you got a brand new industry in which the bureaucracy is in place and rank and file that didn't fight to make the union. That's one part of it. Now, in the shops of the UAW that were already in place, those workers who were radicalized by the experience of having formed a union, a lot of them are going to be drafted into the service. And a lot of them are going to go into war industries themselves and move. And to take their places are going to be brand new workers who didn't have the CIO experience in that shop. Now, they look upon the local presidents and so on as big shots instead of former co-workers that you're the equal of. So and in the Sailors Union, for example, all the offshore maritime unions, NMU included, it meant that you were at sea 10 months a year or involved somewhere away from the port where you were involved in the strikes and in the union. So the World War II was a 4-year gift to the bureaucracy, the new bureaucracy, giving them free hand to cement their total bureaucracy in place. By 1943 and 4, Lundberg was utilizing the powers of the Coast Guard as the Gestapo of the American merchant seamen to keep down opposition against himself. And so was Joe Kern down the way. Now, the guys that Germer, for example, could most count on in finding rank and filers to do what he wanted to do when he went in to kill the spontaneous stuff and the stuff of the rank and file with the CPers. Because with that kind of a deal, like the deal between Bridges and Lewis, with that kind of deal, these guys are guaranteed an inside door to running the joint. And it says something about, I won't go into the details of the case we were talking about earlier today, where the guy is, on the one hand, he's a socialist, but he's going to be a top bureaucrat, very possibly. And he's going to live this dual existence, where he's going to say he's one thing here and say he's another thing there. And so we find, by the time I get to Washington, D.C., a bureaucracy that has not only built itself bastion.